Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the Super Bowl is behind us. The Baltimore Ravens are the national champions, and there were some mighty fine commercials to watch.
There were, and it was pretty exciting when that blackout happened as well, even at the Super Bowl. And I was struck, of course, Mark, I think everybody in healthcare is, by the power of the hits these athletes take, and so pleased to see the NFL is going to try and tackle the rampant problem of head injury, too many blows to the head and neck.
And also President Obama spoke upon that matter before the Super Bowl, so we hope it brings everyone's attention to a very serious crisis.
Of course, there's the threat of thousands of former players filing lawsuits against the NFL for life-altering injuries sustained on the field, but it's all about prevention and research, and I'm pleased to see the league is partnering with GE to research and develop better diagnostic tools.
And hopefully they'll find better ways to reduce these injuries to athletes.
So from the battle on the gridiron to the battle over healthcare funding, analysts predict that President Obama may be relenting on the call to reduce Medicare spending as one strategy to address budget issues.
The entitlement discussion is very likely going to dominate the budget debate, but I saw something else regarding the healthcare law that will likely be the discussion at many state levels. A report out this week looked across the country, and 39 states have no laws in place protecting consumer rights pertaining to the Affordable Care Act.
The Commonwealth Fund issued the report, cited this lack of consumer protection laws for people seeking insurance, especially the provision that guarantees coverage even if they have pre-existing conditions. And I guess I'm surprised. I didn't realize the states had to act on this one.
They do. And states like California, Connecticut, Maryland, Rhode Island, and Oregon, not surprisingly, are the states ahead of the curve in terms of setting up insurance exchanges, which many states are opting not to do.
So it appears, once again, the federal government will have to step in with some protective measures for those states that don't have these consumer protection laws on their books.
And as we get the health law off the ground this year, I suspect we'll see more states moving towards adoption of the law provisions in the future.
And speaking of the future, Mark, our guest today has a particular focus on the future and what healthcare is likely to look like.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is the executive director of Future Med at Singularity University, analyzing how advances and technology are going to change the way we consume and deliver healthcare.
And some of the best innovators in the industry are gathered this week at FutureMed 2013. So lots of exciting new ideas should emerge from the gathering.
Lori Robertson checks in with factcheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Daniel Kraft in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Obama administration attempted to quell the ongoing controversy surrounding the provision of the Affordable Care Act that all women be provided contraception free of charge by their health plans. With over 50 lawsuits aimed at challenging the law's provision, mostly from religious institutions, the administration offered a compromise last week. The institutions filing objections due to religious beliefs would be exempt themselves from funding contraception for employees, but even self-insured institutions like the Catholic Church would have to hire a third-party insurer to handle the contraception issue. The offer was meant as an olive branch to smooth over vociferous objection to that aspect of the health care law, but it's not being well received by a number of the parties involved. A lawyer representing those objecting the ruling say that for-profit, family-owned private companies should also reserve the right to object to that mandate. As the budget debate looms in Congress, it appears Medicaid will be left relatively unscathed. The national health plan that covers one in five Americans living at or near the poverty line will see their access to Medicaid and CHIP continue unabated. Medicaid had been included in the list of programs up for discussion in the deficit reduction talks. And in the progress, not perfection category, kids are making ever so slight progress in some parts of the nation where obesity is concerned. In cities like New York and Philadelphia, where aggressive prevention and nutrition programs are in place, there's been a slight reversal in the numbers of kids determined to be obese or overweight. And now, snacks sold in U.S. schools will need to be lower in fat, salt, and sugar and include more nutritious items like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains under new standards proposed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The proposal calls for a limit of 200 calories on items sold during the school day at vending machines or other venues outside the school lunch line. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Daniel Kraft, chair of the medicine track at Singularity University at NASA Ames in Mountain View, California, in the heart of Silicon Valley. He is the executive director and curator for Future Med, a program which explores convergent, exponentially developing technologies and their potential in biomedicine and healthcare. Both an internist and pediatrician specializing in hematology, oncology, and stem cell transplantation. Dr. Kraft is also founder of IntelliMedicine, an organization focused on promoting data-driven personalized medicine. Dr. Kraft received his medical and scientific training at Harvard and Stanford. Dr. Kraft, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
You know, I'm fascinated with the concept of Singularity University, founded by Ray Kurzweil and some of the world's top thought leaders in innovation and disruptive technologies across many disciplines. Your mission is to assemble, educate, inspire leaders who can facilitate the development of exponentially advancing technologies and apply these tools to address humanity's grand challenges. Give us an idea of some of the most important disruptive technologies you're focused in on, both in medicine and biotechnology.
Well, I think one of the aims of Singularity University and the FutureMed program is to get it out of any one sort of technology bucket and sort of mix them together. So one of the relatively new things we do here is get folks out of their usual sort of silo, whether it's in any technology bucket or academic field. And it's really where these things are coming together and converging, whether that's the world of 3D printing, which is starting to impact the world of healthcare, from printing prosthetics to organs, to the world of big data and IT. And certainly the world of mobile is exploding in the world of digital healthcare and mobile healthcare. It's these things coming together across multiple disciplines, as you mentioned, where things get exciting and helps inspire people to see where the puck is going and where the potentials are to reinvent major fields, including elements of health and biomedicine.
Well, let's talk for a moment, if we can, maybe about the medicine piece or the medical piece, because one of the many roles you play at Singularity is the executive director of the Future Med program, where each year, I understand, you bring together some of the most forward-thinking minds, the cutting-edge people we would think in medicine and biotech. Tell us more about the mission of Future Med specifically, and can you maybe give us a little bit of insight into the topics that you expect to dominate this year's Future Med 2013?
Sure. Here at Singularity University, we every quarter or so run sort of executive programs that bring folks from different fields together. And one of the areas that really turns people on from different arenas is health and medicine, with how technology touches upon that. So decided a couple of years ago, given all that interest, to create a program called Future Med. And what's interesting there is that instead of the usual medical conferences I'll standardly go to, I'm a hematologist, I'll go to the American Society of Hematology, or cardiologists will go to the American Society of Cardiology, is we get people mixed together from different fields and with different perspectives on both the clinical arena, pharma, data, IT, and beyond. And the mission is really to get people thinking a bit differently and to cross-fertilize and to recognize how fast certain technologies are moving. I mean, the iPad, for example, now has about 70% penetration in terms of physicians in the U.S. owning those, and that's changing the way we're doing healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so at FutureMed, we bring all these sort of elements together, give people a bit of a deep dive in education into what's sort of happening, and let them think about how they might reinvent elements of health and medicine. So some of the hot topics, for example, and thought leaders will bring in will be the lead physician from IBM Watson, mm-hmm. looking at where artificial intelligence can take healthcare and where it's already impacting our ability to leverage all these masses of information in smart ways for diagnostics and therapeutic decisions. We're bringing in well-known investors like Vinod Khosla, who co-founded Sun Microsystems, but is looking at how and is funding, you know, smaller companies that are part of this now new sort of milieu of startups and devices that, when they come together, have the power to really shift the needle and the way that physicians and patients deal with medical data, how we collect it, how we interpret it. And, you know, one other hot area that I mentioned that we have some focus on is the world of omics and personalized medicine. One of the fields that's changing exponentially is that of the speed and price of sequencing a genome. It's now about $1,000 and can be done in about a day. And that has massive implications to how clinicians and individuals understand their own information, but also challenges about how do we bring that into the clinical landscape. How does a primary care doctor take your mm-hmm. pharmacogenetics, for example, and make that useful when they prescribe a drug or a therapy?
Mm-hmm. And you really
sort of walk through that waterfront of changes that are going on in technology and diagnosis and in healthcare. And you use sort of as the paradigm the stethoscope, which had remained relatively unchanged for over a century. And you say that your stethoscope is now digital, and you note that there's an app for that. But it's a paradigm, and it's reflective of the overall trend in medicine where technology is making everything faster, smaller, cheaper, and better. And while technology is certainly disrupting the status quo, tell us how you're addressing the problem of the really what seems to be intransigence within the healthcare community to adapt technology.
Sure. Well, the medical community and the healthcare system is really multiple systems. And, you know, all too often, the incentives are sort of misaligned. And the challenge with some of these new technologies is, you know, quote unquote, who's going to pay for it? Whether that's a digital stethoscope or a new app that can help, you know, prevent someone who's pre-diabetic from moving into diabetes by better managing their exercise and their blood sugars and being socially connected. And, you know, we can talk a bit more about the big changes in healthcare economics, but today we spend about 80% of our healthcare dollar on those who are chronically sick or the last couple years of life. There's a bit of a shift now to rewarding, you know, the incentives into keeping people healthier and more on top of their early diagnosis or disease states. And that can have a huge paradigm shift. And when a physician now, let's say a primary physician, is rewarded for keeping their patients with good blood pressure control or good blood sugars for their diabetics, that changes the needle and can take devices now. Like if you walk into a Best Buy or an Apple store, you can see a shelf now of consumer healthcare products, whether they're blood pressure cuffs that connect to your smartphone and can transmit blood pressure numbers or glucometers that are built into attachments for iPhones or others, or you know this new era of quantified self devices that can help track exercise. And as those things start to show their value, and big payers like Medicare or some of the big insurers see the value in that, they're going to start rewarding those. And that's where the shift starts to happen. And that's starting to happen as some of the big payers are even buying app companies and integrating them into their bigger plans. And some larger associations like Kaiser or the VA, where they're both a payer and the player, can start to pilot these programs and see the value of, for example, a connected blood pressure cuff and take things forward.
That's so interesting because you lay that out so clearly. And we recognize there's a slew of data gathering devices that are out there. We've seen them at the recent consumer electronics shows that have apps and gadgets for all kinds of metric gathering. But where we still seem to lag is having a system that actually collects all that personalized data into a cohesive picture of where we are as patients and what we would call actionable data for their primary care teams or their specialist teams, what people can actually respond to. So what's in your crystal ball in terms of a unified platform that might pull all these technological advances and diagnostics together?
Yeah, well, one of the big challenges in healthcare is that often the data collected is not on the same platform or language. And one of the opportunities we have now with still pretty much consumer devices, I'm wearing, for example, a Basis watch that measures my motion and activity as well as my heart rate, or there's ones that measure your sleep. The challenge is that they're creating huge amounts of data, and they're all from different streams and different buckets. The trick is, as you mentioned, is to pull it all together. I like to use the analogy of, you know, the modern car, which has hundreds or sometimes thousands of different sensors, one on each tire, piston, oil, et cetera. And as the driver, you don't care about, you know, the pressure and piston number three. You care about when your check engine light comes on, and then hopefully you bring it into your mechanic before the engine blows up or you blow a gasket, and they can help plug in the diagnostics and look at all the data from your engine and prevent a major mechanical issue. Or, you know, God forbid, if you crash in your car, some of these systems like the OnStar system will call 911. And I think we're starting to see startups and entrepreneurs and bigger systems start to integrate all these data streams, that you have your own sort of check engine light for the body, kind of like the OnStar for the body. And as new players are opening up their APIs so people can share these data streams, I think we're going to see this thing integrated. And that's going to frankly require, you know, smart algorithms, learning engines, you know, artificial intelligence, which I like to actually call intelligence augmentation, so that you as an individual or as a caregiver or as a physician can not have to leaf through a pile of genetic code, but it sort of integrates that for you and says, well, this patient has this genotype, has had this activity. We know they've checked to the gym two times, but McDonald's six times, and that they haven't been sleeping as well as normal. Maybe we need to adjust this medicine based on their genetics and their activity and their diet. And as we start to crowdsource all that, I think we have a huge amount of opportunity. I think we can soon sign up to be data donors, health data donors, and by pulling these information streams together from hospitals, individuals, practices, we can start to have a dashboard for ourselves as well as our practices and a whole population.
We're speaking today with Dr. Daniel Kraft, Executive Director of Future Med and Chair of the Medical Track at Singularity University in Mountain View, California, which is committed to leveraging the technology to improve healthcare and biomedicine. Dr. Kraft, let's pull the thread a little more on your sort of futuristic vision of healthcare, and particularly interested in one of the seminars at Future Med, and that is how to identify a need, develop the prototype, then go to the marketplace. Currently, the sort of standard from benchside to bedside is around 15 years in sort of the drug research protocol arena, to almost sort of a wild west of innovation that's going on now. How do you advise today's biotech developers to navigate these new waters?
Well, I think partly it's bringing together different parties. I think we're seeing a new generation of accelerators and incubators. One of them is Rock Health, which I advise up in San Francisco, bringing in sort of new thought leaders and innovators from outside of healthcare, people from IT and gaming and people who built Facebook platforms and consumer devices. And the challenge and opportunity is for them to really understand what the unmet need is. I was fortunate as a fellow at Stanford to go through the biodesign program when it was starting up about a decade ago. And the key thing really is to understand the unmet need, to spend time in the clinic, you know, understand what drug or therapy is needed, what that device is going to do. What used to, you know, require $1 million lab can now be done almost in your garage, whether that's with synthetic biology or 3D printers to build early prototypes. There's the ability to now innovate more quickly and access, you know, some of this big data that's part of the NIH repositories. And finally, to understand where the puck is moving so that you're building a system that takes some of these technologies in mind. If we're going to have a $100 genome in a couple of years, should your database have a space for that? And then finally, understanding the incentives for the physician, for the patient, for the payer, so that the solution you're building ends up creating value. It should be built for when we have, you know, the iPad 7 and the low-cost genomics and sequencing available to almost all of us.
You know, Daniel, I have to admit, I'm still stuck with the image in my mind of how much easier healthcare would be if the check engine light came on in all of our patients. But in all seriousness, I want to talk about the costs in healthcare for a minute. We've just had a report that for the third year in a row, the actual trend in the rise of healthcare costs has been the slowest rise since we started keeping track of it. So clearly some things are moving in the right direction. What's the focus in terms of looking at the impact overall of this advancement of faster, smaller, cheaper, better technologies? Who's looking at that? Where's the creative work going on there in understanding the impact on cost?
Well, part of it is being leveraged by the sort of digitization of healthcare data, electronic medical records, which has still been very expensive to implement. We'll actually have on our faculty this year Farzad Mastashari, who's the head of the UNC, who I was a resident with at Mass General, and they're sort of laying some of the groundwork. Some of these expensive tools to put in meaningful use and electronic medical records have some certain costs and challenges. But as we start to have more connected healthcare, when we can sort of have that, what I like to call stage zero medicine, whether it's that check engine light, you know, helping you pick up a cancer diagnosis or signs of heading towards a stroke or heart attack earlier, you can save massive amounts of dollars downstream. So I think we look at where, again, is the puck going with these technologies? Where do they start to touch each other and enable us to reinvent things? You know, for many of us, it almost would seem anachronistic to go and rent a video or a CD from a video store. Now it's streaming. The way we take photos has dramatically changed in the last decade. How we read, how we get books has all dramatically shifted and disrupted entire fields. That's starting to happen in healthcare, whether that's sort of e-dermatology. It's starting to happen with telemedicine, where visits don't require a 3-hour wait. Those are all sort of small elements coming together. And as the incentives again shift, if you can now show to your insurer that you've quit smoking, that you're going to the gym, that you're burning this many calories and you're doing 10,000 steps a day, that can incentivize lowering your premium. If we can start to leverage some of these tools together in smart ways and integrate them, as we mentioned, we have the opportunity to start focusing on the prevention end and not where we spend most of our dollars now on the super high tech end, where folks have already had the stroke, the heart attack, the late stage cancer diagnosis. So it's no one piece. It's all those together. And what we hope to do at FutureMed and Singularity University is start open people's eyes to the pace of change, the opportunities and challenges, and how they can reinvent some elements of traditional healthcare.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Daniel Kraft, the Executive Director of FutureMed and Chair of the Medicine Track at Singularity University at the NASA Ames campus in Silicon Valley. You can find out more about the work they do by going to singularityu.org or to futuremed2020.com. Dr. Kraft, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we're continuing to see many claims being made about gun control, a public health issue. In particular, the 1994 assault weapons ban has taken center stage. Both sides in this debate are cherry-picking portions of academic reports on that ban. The CEO of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre, told a Senate committee that the ban, quote, had no impact on lowering crime. But the studies he cited said it was too soon to make a definitive assessment of the ban's impact. On the Democratic side, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who recently introduced new legislation banning assault weapons, said the old law did reduce crime. Well, that's wrong, too. The study said it could not conclude that the ban was responsible for a national drop in gun violence. Both sides are citing a series of three studies that concluded with a 2004 report on the ban, which lasted from 1994 to 2004 and banned the manufacture of many firearms. Any pre-ban assault weapons were grandfathered in, meaning there were still an estimated 1.5 million such weapons in circulation. The studies said that the ban had mixed results. Crimes involving assault weapons did decline, but there was an increase in the use of other guns. The research found it was simply, quote, premature to make definitive assessments of the ban's impact. The author of the study recently said the ban might have modestly reduced shootings if it had lasted longer, but the impact would be modest. Assault weapons were used in only 2% of gun crimes before the ban. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Pia Sarkar was a graduate student in public health at Stanford University, a trip to India changed her whole perspective. In spite of the massive efforts underway to curb the spread of HIV and AIDS, 2.5 million people are still being infected around the globe every year, and she realized that many of the barriers to properly educating the public were cultural in nature.
Because of the taboos and because of the stigma, HIV is extremely difficult to talk about, let alone teach about, especially in certain parts of the world. The knowledge level still remain pretty low.
And in many parts of India, sex education is banned. That set Sarkar on a four-year quest to perfect the training materials being used by multiple health workers in the field. And she discovered that because of taboos, the education videos had to be animated much more simply.
We have explicit images, which are extremely clear. However, a lot of educators don't want to use these pictures. Students feel uncomfortable using these kinds of pictures. But even more importantly, we know that when you're uncomfortable, that limits learning. And in many parts of the world where sex education is banned or it's difficult to talk about AIDS education, such pictures are actually not allowed.
And she also found that translating the copy into different languages could completely alter the meaning of the words. So they set out to ensure that translations were fully vetted and cross-referenced before being deployed.
And you find all these problems in your original translation. So then you go back to the translation, make corrections there, and then create yet another back translation. You do this over and over and over until your final English translation is very similar to your original English translation.
Sarkar took that 4 years of research on creating more effective AIDS training videos and launched Teach AIDS. Her videos have been translated into 30 languages, are deployed on the ground in 70 countries, and are being utilized by 180 non-governmental organizations on the ground trying to stem the spread of AIDS. And each video is delivered in the vernacular of the nation where it's being shared.
Hello, what can I do for you? Doctor, I've heard a lot about HIV, but I don't really understand what it is.
She hopes to deploy the free video program to the top 50 nations in the world who have a million or more people living with HIV/AIDS. A simple, well-researched video designed to be specific to all end users and the cultures in which they live. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.